You've seen our research on social media. Now, join us as we dive deeper into the public health topics of our time, featuring new studies and findings generated by our faculty and researchers committed to advancing health equity. From the Department of Population and Public Health Sciences at Keck School of Medicine of USC, this is Preventive Pros, the podcast.
My name is Ans Irfan. I'm an associate professor in Environmental Health Division here at Department of Public Health, Keck School of Medicine. And most of my work is focused primarily on teaching. And I also support the teaching program, thinking about infusing innovation within our broader portfolio, especially trying to respond to opportunities and challenges coming from artificial intelligence as well as climate education. So yeah, that's where kind of my work is focused on, and research broadly is around climate justice, but teaching is where really my heart is at. So my research is fairly multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary, and I know that those are terms that are thrown around quite a bit, but that's really just when a lot of fields come together and inform and co-constitute a certain framework and help us analyze the situation and then produce solutions based on those different perspectives is where kind of my intellectual happy spot is. And as far as like research is concerned, broadly, especially when it comes to climate change, it's really focused on kind of like the broader areas of climate justice as it concerns climate innovation and technology. So thinking about how can we make technology more equitable from a grounds up perspective, especially bringing the voices of those at the margins of the society, as opposed to coming up with an intervention in the Silicon Valley and asking everyone to just bow down. So how do you flip that equation altogether? And then some of their research also informs the philanthropic sector and how they distribute their money around the world, including the United States, through that equity lens when it comes to climate innovation. Another broader area is climate justice and global health system strengthening. So thinking about how can we make health systems around the world more climate adaptive and climate sensitive to just really rapidly changing and shifting climate around in those particular countries that are very, very climate vulnerable. And the other overarching category really is it's more theoretical in a sense that it draws from moral philosophy, and it looks at both climate governance, climate leadership, and climate policy decision-making from a decolonial lens, and trying to answer that, why do we continue to make decisions that are not fundamentally changing the system, but sustaining the status quo, but making it look pretty? So how do we challenge that and analyze it and then move towards answers that how do you respond to that? But that's kind of where my broader research related to climate and environmental justice focuses on. At the tail end of my medical journey, I always knew I was not going to practice clinical medicine, but I did for about a year or so just to schmooze my dad. Schmoozing did not work out, but that was the time when I really figured out there was such a thing called public health. And I was working on a project around brick factory workers and their heat exposure. And a lot of those workers are women, and poor women who are working in these terrible conditions and just extremely high heat. So initially, my thought process really was just thinking about how the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics of prescription drugs are playing out in this particular case, where it's not the optimal ecosystem in which they're operating. But then the question that I asked myself that's trying to answer that question is the same as practicing clinical medicine, where you're just trying to fix the individual and not changing their system. So I dug a little further that why was heat exposure a big issue? And that kind of led me to occupational health or worker health, which led me to climate change. And so that was kind of my more immediate sort of like, you know, way into climate change and trying to figure out that it has a name and there's a whole discipline slash field that kind of focuses on it. And retrospectively, it's also been an issue without knowing myself directly that was an issue that, you know, that has impacted me and people closer to me my entire life. I grew up in a really small village in a former British colony, where these folks left really hideous scars of their brutality on that geography in Pakistan. And they diverted all the canal system and waterways and really destroyed all of the ecosystems in so many different ways. And that continues to pay a dividend, that colonialism. And part of that colonial dividend is water scarcity, which was something that for my family, who were a farming family, directly impacted both your income and family dysfunction and everything else around it. So all this to say that applying that retrospective lens, you also see that this is an issue that has impacted a lot of people in so many direct ways, but just because we didn't use the language of climate change, and I'm using air quotes, it kind of like, you know, like, yeah, from a Western imagination that, oh, people don't have the knowledge of climate change, even though they're living through it. So they have the lived experience, but they don't have the Western language to describe it. They have other ways of discussing all that sort of like in a colonial legacy, which frankly what climate change is. So yeah, that's a kind of my way into climate change and health. So I think like it's I don't mean to sound pessimistic, and I'll probably say it again, I'm an obnoxiously optimistic person. But what I do think is one of the things that I've been thinking about looking at the current landscape is just how much of that is rooted in American individualism. So a lot of the research that we produce, a lot of the questions that we ask, a lot of the solutions that we produce are basically very individualistic, which tell people that if only you fixed your behavior, if only you got a Tesla, if only you did XYZ, that's going to change the system, and it's not. And the other issue there, the bigger issue also, is that from just about any projection you look at, you can start with the United Nations, UNFCCC, to the United States, and just about any projection you look at currently with our current climate policies, we're heading towards planetary collapse. And there's no denying that part, right? So like, and I think like as scientists, we do a bit of a disservice when we just continue to pretend that this is somehow a normal thing, and we don't need an even bigger, greater sense of urgency around climate action. So that's one of the things that I've been thinking about, that we should stop selling climate hope snake oil that we've been doing for a long time, which really is just, again, American individualism packaged as that, oh, some imaginary technology in the future is going to help save us, and it's not. And that's frankly has always been the U.S. Governmental policy when Democrats are in power, that there is going to be some future technology that's going to help resolve climate change. And the question that I ask myself, and I encourage my students to ask themselves, is whether or not they think that we have plenty of good technology to fix hunger. And we do. And yet you see starvation from Gaza to Yemen and everywhere else in between. There are many, many, many poor kids starving and going hungry in the United States of America. So it's not a question of technology. It's a question of broader moral question, how we have structured the society. So I say that all to say that I think like the we need to move past that part of individualism in terms of our solutions and our analytics, and move towards that. What are the fundamental cultural, societal, moral rot that we've normalized that need to be challenged, and how do we move past that? So I think like one of the key important things that I encourage them to think about is that sense of hopelessness, it's not normal to humans. It's the system itself cultivates that sense of hopelessness. And that thing is done through, you know, there's a loneliness epidemic in this country, right? So if not around the globe, there's a reason that people feel more and more lonely. And there's this like lack of sense of communal connections that people no longer have, right? So like, and all of that is a function of the way we've structured our society. We can talk about our work, we can talk about our schooling, education, and so on and so forth. All of that encourages, prioritizes rock stars and individuals, and again, like, you know, rooted in individualism. So the key thing I encourage them, so all this pretense to say that the key thing, couple of things that I invite them to think about is that sense of hopelessness is, A, it's not normal or organic. It's the system itself trying to create yet another mechanism to self-propel itself, right? Like, because it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy if you continue to repeat it, that there's nothing we can do about that part, right? And the other important thing I always invite them to think about is that for many of my students who are Black or brown and or non-cis white men, and for most of those folks, including myself as a genderqueer scholar of color, we were impossibilities in these academic spaces only a few decades ago. You can look at Black people, you can look at brown people, you can look at women, you can look at across those particular categories, right? And today that is a normal thing that, like, you know, none of us would be sitting there and someone couldn't say that, like, you know, women should not be allowed to go to college, right? So, like, you know, but that was a normal thing only a few decades ago. But today that is not a normal thing, which is a long-winded way of saying that just because it has, the violence has been normalized and the climate inaction has been normalized to an extent, that doesn't mean that they should let go of that bigger picture, right? So, like, you know, they should remember, just take a long view of history and not get bogged down with this narrow, small cross section of history, but think about that broadly. We've bent the moral arc of the universe historically, and we will bend it again when it comes to climate change. And importantly, I have this quote by Ursula Le Guin that I always encourage them to consider when it comes to imagination, that be imaginative. And she basically says that the exercise of imagination is dangerous to those who profit from the way things are, because it has the power to show that the way things are is not permanent, not universal, not necessary. And I think with about that quote and think with that author quite a bit, and I invite my students to think about it quite a bit as well, to be much more imaginative, right? So, like, and not just play within the confines that are given to us, but think about, like, how do you break free from it and start from scratch when it comes to our policy ecosystem. I think, like, the biggest achievement from, again, thinking about maybe one of the classes I just taught this semester was on culture and health. So culture is really on my mind in so many different ways, even though I think we should be scrutinizing the concept of culture itself, but I digress. I think, like, one of the biggest progress that we've made is, and it has come from Gen Z and the younger generation, is that scrutinizing and questioning and saying that the emperor has no clothes. Which is to say that these are folks who are really challenging that why are the way things are, the way they are, why is it, right? So these are the people who are questioning, really asking some really foundational, profound questions that do we really need to structure our society around capitalism, for instance, right? Because, like, why our entire existence revolves around productivity and the productivity, again, to make profits for very small percentage of humanity and not so much productivity going towards humans, right? So, like, you know, it's not productivity for anything that's good for the universe other than profits that are being made for the rich and the powerful, right? So, like, you know, and a lot of academic institutions, they too are a function of and replication of that capitalistic neoliberal model where the bottom line remains producing more money, right? So the progress, I would say, in my view, biggest progress has been that people are asking some really important, good, foundational questions. That why is it that we continue our perpetual wars when we have climate change to fight for? Why is it that we continue to insist that capitalism is the answer? And I think, like, that in my view is a major, major, major progress that need to be both acknowledged and uplifted and highlighted. And especially I would focus, again, all thanks to the younger generation who have been at the forefront of leading that conversation. I think, like, I'm reminded of Martin Luther King's analysis of what was it? It being gravely disappointed with the white moderate, because the challenge there really is the governance, bipartisan governance failure on climate change. I teach one of the concepts in my climate course called path dependency, which basically says that our choices today are going to inform, or rather limit, our choices in the future. Right? One of the challenges in public health or academia generally is that someone walking into this space, they really need to try to distinguish the difference between public health slash climate change being political versus public health slash climate change being partisan. And it is very political because our very existence is very political, but it's not partisan and it should not be partisan. When we create that dichotomy, a false dichotomy, that when it's one party controls the House or any of these power levers, we become quiet about that part and we just don't extend the same vigor and vigorous critique as we should be extending. So that's one of the things I would invite someone walking into this space, like is to consider that sort of like, you know, bipartisan governance failure and both acknowledge that equation and then think about how do they want to intervene into that? And I talk about that part because I could talk about sort of like, you know, more specific elements that like, you know, do this, like, you know, just learn this course, learn that skill. But that, again, goes back to that individualism where we started the conversation. And I think like our questions are more philosophical that we need to be answering and be a lot more self-reflective that we've been in a very long time. One of the frameworks that I study is cultural violence. And so what cultural violence basically tells us is to think about, it's basically the notion that how certain normalized aspects of society that are really rooted in this idea of cultural violence, they normalize both structural violence as well as direct violence, right? Climate change example would be, for instance, that normalized forms of cultural violence, in my view, capitalism, neoliberalism, they enable structural violence, which is really that Black and brown people not having air conditioning when heat is going up. They're the one who are getting most impacted by wildfires and so on and so forth, right? So that's your structural violence. And then there's direct violence that those wildfires or those floods and so on and so forth, they too end up directly impacting Black and brown folks. So when you acknowledge really that sort of like when you apply that cultural violence framework, it really helps you understand that the root cause really isn't that people are not recycling or any of it. It's the lack of accountability when it comes to politicians. It's our just totally wrong way of thinking and approaching some of these fundamental questions that really is their sort of like, you know, the crux of the problem that we need to move away from. What are the, some of the key high notes of things that we can do is really, I think, like embracing advocacy. And I mean, advocacy in a much more vigorous way than we do at the moment. It is not part of the way we've structured academia, right? And I think like, so as academics, we need to think about like, what are those structural solutions that we can offer? And how do we move towards that world that we're imagining beyond, again, you recycle it. And that's where I think like we really need to both analyze and produce models that are alternative to the way we've currently structured our society and our economic systems. Like, so how do we imagine a world where we're not spending millions upon millions upon millions of dollars trying to study how to make this one Medicare program more efficient, but move towards a world where we say that like people have a right to get basic healthcare. That should not be a radical proposition. Or, you know, a 3 days work week, because we need to adapt to the changing climate so people can spend more time thinking about, again, a changing world and or solutions. Universal basic income, so people have more time and capacity to both deal with these challenges, as well as both the from philosophical perspective, from practical perspective, and producing more generative solutions to help us move towards that world. And we need to really rethink how we operate.
Preventive Pros, the podcast, is produced by the Department of Population and Public Health Sciences at Keck School of Medicine of USC. To learn more about any of our episodes, or to subscribe to our monthly Preventive Dose newsletter featuring the latest in public health research and news, visit pphs.usc.edu/podcast. Thank you for listening.